Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Lawrence Ralph is a Princeton professor who studies gangs and youth violence. He's been drawn to ethnography, getting in close with struggling communities. He'd written about a torture program instituted by the Chicago police and disabled former gang members. But his new book, Sito, An American Teenager and the City That Failed Him, is much more personal. It's about what happened when a member of his extended family was killed in San Francisco in retaliation for a murder he didn't commit. We're going to talk about what we call gang violence, juvenile justice reform, and breaking the cycles of murder that plague our cities. That's coming up next, right after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. In 2014, a boy named Rashawn Williams, just 14, went to a corner store with his younger brother Julius to buy some candy. As they stepped outside the shop at 26th and Folsom in the Mission in San Francisco, they spotted Rashawn's middle school classmate, Luis Alberto Quiñones, known as Sito, who was with his friend, Miguel. Within moments, turf trash talk became a quick altercation. Surveillance footage shows that Miguel stabbed Rashawn, turned out to be a fatal injury. But it would be Sito who would be wrongly arrested and then released for the murder. And in a few years' time, Miguel, who was never arrested or convicted for Rashawn's death, would be killed. And so would Sito. His killer, Rashawn's brother, Julius. It's a tragic, tragic, tragic story. And it's a deeply personal one, too, for our guest this morning. Through his wife, Lawrence Ralph is part of Sito's extended family. They were kin, and Lawrence found himself inside the kind of story that he'd studied over and over again in his academic work. Thank you for joining us this morning, Lawrence.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So I'm not sure anybody can ever really understand what happened that day and the way that it spiraled into all these families' lives. But if anyone's research could have prepared him for this, it was probably you, no?
I think so. I mean, I spent over a decade thinking about gang violence and thinking very specifically about retaliation and thinking about the injuries that accrue from gang violence as well. And even though it was in the context of Chicago, I think I learned a lot of things that helped me understand the complexity of this case in particular.
Yeah. So we're going to see how your book kind of tried to extract meaning from this tragedy. But maybe you can walk us through a little bit of what happened with those boys on that street corner. Like, where had Sito and Miguel been earlier that day? And kind of what were they doing over there?
Well, that incident is an anchor in the book. It's one that I come to in my own head over and over again. And it's the result of four boys confronting each other, right? And that event outside of Reuben's Market would change each of their lives in different ways. Mm. And it came as a result of Miguel and Sito walking the neighborhood and confronting Rashawn and Julius, his little brother. And the thing about that incident is something that could have easily not happened.
Right.
You know, if they had passed each other 2 minutes earlier, or if Rashawn and his brother had stayed in the store 2 minutes later, they could have easily missed each other. But they happened to come out at the same time. They happened to go back and forth a little bit, and it happened to escalate in a fight, and that fight would change the course of everyone's life.
So Sito and Miguel, as you kind of narrate in the book, had been hanging out at a park. It's the park that's right at the end of Balmy, Garfield Park. And they were hanging out with some older guys, right, who were kind of part of the Norteños, I understand it, right?
Yes, that's right.
And then as we think about the sort of gangs of this area, or what we, you know, what we call gangs, or how we think about them. It's very complex, I understand, from the book as well as from your work. But we also have another force in the streets that's sort of Army Street, that is kind of who claims the territory that's a little south, of Garfield Park. And so Sito and Miguel were kind of what? They were kind of looking for other, they were looking for some trouble, maybe not as much trouble as ended up coming to them. But like, what were they doing when they were out kind of walking around?
Yeah, I think they were, you know, trying to impress the older guys in the neighborhood, trying to prove that they could be one of them if they wanted, trying to prove that, you know, young boys of their age, you know, had the wherewithal to uphold this legacy. And it, you know, it's a mistake that teenagers often make. And this time it happened to be a tragic mistake.
Yeah. I mean, how should we even think about, you know, like gang turf wars in the era of this book, you know, in this, in, you know, 10 years ago or, you know, right now? Like, how do you think about it as a researcher?
Yeah, I mean, I think right now it's interesting to think about because you have the overlapping of what's going on in terms of Silicon Valley, what's going on in terms of the tech industry, and kind of radical inequality, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's easy to see and not see. It's easy to for some people to walk these same neighborhoods and not see any gang affiliations, and for other people, it's communities that have a history of this, and for young people in particular from marginalized communities, young people of color, they're navigating the history, and they're navigating their marginalized position now in terms of social inequality, and so. One thing I tried to do was to kind of point to those juxtapositions for someone now who, you know, they're in an impossible situation, young people. They can't fulfill the obligations of the gangs as it used to be because the community doesn't exist as it used to be. At the same time, they can't, you know...
They can't just like learn how to code and
right. So I think they're stuck in between. They're searching for their identity at the same time, and often how that plays out in a search for power, unfortunately, it plays out in violence.
Yeah. So after Rashaan was killed, I mean, how did the media and the police respond to what happened?
Well, the next day, Sito was arrested. And he was arrested. He was 14 years old at the time. He was put in juvenile hall at the time. And the media, you know, characterized him as a youth murderer and the person responsible for Rashaan's death. And so that allegation would basically haunt him for the rest of his life. And he was never able to outrun that allegation. Mm. And so I think it's important that we think about, you know, the idea of guilty until proven innocent and what it means when, in this day and age in particular, you have not only the media, but you have social media running with the assumption that someone is guilty and how that impacts them, especially if they're 14 years old.
Yeah, gosh, there's a scene in the book. It's happening on Facebook in the book. Of course, that would probably be happening on Instagram, where Sito is watching the likes come in on stories that basically are like accusing him of murder, or that he knows will be around him. Like that, these are people who are organizing to keep and put him in jail for a long time. What do we know about why the DA, and may not be that much, why the DA went after Sito when there was this surveillance video that came out afterwards that showed that it was Miguel who had done the stabbing?
Yeah, I think that what we don't know is exactly when the DA was aware of the surveillance footage. We know that the public defender's office under Jeff Adachi found the footage, and after months of Sito being incarcerated, and presented DA with the footage at the time. But we don't know what happened before then, if they were aware of the video before then. But what we do know is that once the video was presented, he wasn't...
Presented publicly.
Yeah, presented publicly. He still wasn't released immediately. It took a while for him to be released. And in that time period, that was a period where Sito went through a lot of struggles. Because, you know, knowing that you're innocent is one thing. But knowing that the DA knows you're innocent and still being arrested and still being incarcerated is a different thing. And Sito had that experience, that, and it really, I think, caused a lot of long-term damage and trauma for him.
Yeah. I mean, how had Sito changed by the time he emerged from, you know, juvenile hall? I mean, was he on a good path, or was it, like, more complicated than that?
I think it was more complicated than that. You know, he was the youngest person there at the time when he was incarcerated, and he's there with people who could be up to 22 years old. And I think knowing that you're innocent when you're incarcerated that young does have, you know, it gives you a different experience, because you asserting your innocence, you know, is often read as defiance by the people in charge of you, the authority figures. And so, there again, you're in an impossible situation, because if you assert you're innocent, then you're showing that you're refusing to rehabilitate yourself. And so he was labeled as defiant. He had a hard time, both from the authority figures, but also from the other people who were incarcerated with him. And I think that really impacted him long term.
I mean, how did Sito's family see him? Like, what kind of kid did they see him as?
They saw him as a complex kid, you know, a human being who, you know, had his troubles, but was still striving to be better, and who still had a lot of time on his side. And so I think, you know, one of the things I try to do is to complicate this idea of good or bad kid, or, you know, even victim and perpetrator, because I think, you know, once we put people in that box, we, you know, fail to see them as fully human. And I think that's what's happening, you know, from the media, from the, you know, public response to this event. And to a certain impact, he's doing this to himself as well. He's internalizing some of what people are saying about him.
Yeah. We're talking with Princeton anthropology professor Lawrence Ralph about his new book, Sito, An American Teenager and the City That Failed Him. He's going to appear tonight at 7 p.m. at Mrs. Dalloway Bookstore in Berkeley, just so you know. We'd also love to hear from you. I mean, have you experienced gang violence? You know, what? How did you get out of that cycle? You can email us, forum@kqed.org. You can give us a call, 866-733-6786. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned.
Star One Credit Union provides you with the tech, tools, and terms to control your money and your lifestyle. Simple, seamless, everyday financial services and solutions. Online and mobile banking backed by the latest technology. Great rates on home, auto, and solar loans. And real people providing real assistance when you need it. At Star One, they always put you first. Become a member at staronecredit.org or visit any of their Bay Area locations. Star One Credit Union. In your best interest.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Princeton anthropology professor Lawrence Ralph about his new book, Sito, An American Teenager and the City That Failed Him. It's going to appear tonight at 7 p.m. at Mrs. Dalloway's bookstore in Berkeley. And we're going to get your thoughts on how the juvenile justice system should work. You can email us at forum@kqed.org. Give us a call, 866-733-6786. Let's talk a little bit about the other children who were present there, aside from Rashan, and Sito. We have Miguel, who Sito knew to some extent, and then we have Julius Williams. What happens to these other two boys?
Well, a year after the incident, Miguel is murdered, we think in retaliation for this event. And then, you know, 5 years after, Julius would murder Sito. And so he would become incarcerated. And so, again, that event outside that store would change the trajectory of all of their lives, an event that could have easily not happened. Even if it did happen, it could have happened
could
in
have
a way
gone
that,
a million different ways.
Right, that didn't result in death, right? Yeah. You know?
I mean, the story of Julius Williams, as you tell it in the book, is, he is convicted for Sito's murder, but he's like in prison, he's like a 4.0 student, you know, he's like working hard on his life in all these other ways. And yet this violence still happens, right? I mean, all these, the cycle of violence doesn't end, even though you've got this kid who seems along many different dimensions to kind of have his life together in other ways.
Yeah. And I think that's part of it. You know, we often kind of throw a youth away after they make one mistake, and we assume that that mistake is a reflection of who they are. But who they are is a complex thing. You know, he is someone who at 12 years old saw his brother die in front of him. And I imagined he grew up wishing that he could have done something about that. And that is something that he lived with. And so both can be true. You know, he could be a great student and at the same time be someone who is living with this trauma that he didn't have an outlet for, yeah. Right?
Yeah. Well, I've seen some reporting, at least, that maybe even this retaliatory cycle continued with yet another killing of another person unrelated, but that was sort of seen as revenge, an act of revenge as well. So after all that happened and all that you've seen, you know, in kind of researching youth gangs, I mean, what do you think can change these patterns of violence?
Yeah, I mean, I think from the perspective of Sito's family, the thing that we were worried about most is the prospect of retaliation. And I think ultimately that's why I decided to write the book. But there was one particular moment looking back that became formative for me. Mm-hmm. And that was during Sito's funeral when his dad made a plea mm-hmm. to all the young people in the crowd not to retaliate. And I thought in that moment that it should, you know, outlive this particular funeral. It should outlive this.
Like that plea should resound.
Right. That message needed to be carried on. And so I think that part of what I was trying to think through is how families, even in the moment where they're supposed to be grieving, can't grieve because they're worried about retaliation, right? Yeah. And it's a big issue that we have to try to address.
You know, and Sito's father, Rene, right, had played a big role in his life. And Rene had previously been involved with gangs, right? And then had kind of moved away into trying to get people out of that life, yeah?
Yeah, he had done a lot of anti-violence work, a lot of anti-gang initiatives in San Francisco. He had pioneered the approach of violence interruption in the Bay Area. And so he's a figure that is, widely respected and someone who cares deeply about these cycles.
Wow. I mean, it must, it's just part of the tragedy, right? That even somebody who literally has been doing the work for other people then found themselves like inside one of these cycles.
Yeah, I think it's unpredictable in that way, and it's contingent in that way, where I think part of the experience of being, a youth of color in many urban cities is that you can be a victim of or a perpetrator of violence very easily and very quickly, and it can change the course of your life forever.
Yeah. I mean, how did going through this situation with Sito, you know, both kind of at the time, but maybe perhaps more importantly through the years of work to kind of make this book and spend time with the family. Did that change the way that you have approached your work studying youth gangs and violence?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've been interested for a very long time on how people recover from injuries, how people fit, how people heal. But I never really thought about families in that same way and how it is not just the injury felt by an individual, but it's an injury felt by families. Mm. And entire families are grappling with this. Entire families, as we've been discussing, are caught up in these cycles. And, you know, on the one hand, you have someone who, like Julius, again, who experienced something at a very young age, and he was caught up in the cycle, right? Mm-hmm. And you have, you know, someone like Renee, who is dedicated his life for transformation, and he's caught up in the cycle. And so, you know, how does the pain of violence reverberate, you know?
Were there specific things that you saw in the process of doing this and looking at the way that families were impacted? They feel like families need a different kind of support, or they, you know, the violence interruption needs to intersect with the family in a different way?
Yeah, I think there needs to be dedicated support mechanisms for families to kind of process what they're going through and to heal and to think about other outlets to, you know, express their grief. I think part of it is that when someone in your family is labeled a perpetrator, it's almost as if you're not supposed to grieve for them. You're just supposed to say, oh, they got themselves in that kind of trouble, so they deserve their fate. Mm. But everybody's affected, too, in a family. And, and so there needs to be resources for families to kind of cope with that and grieve on the perpetrator and the victim side of things. And a lot of that right now comes on the family themselves to figure out their own way through this. Mm. And, you know, I think that leads to more cycles of violence.
Let's bring in a call. Let's bring in Sean up in Richmond. Welcome, Sean.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, I just wanted to share that, you know, this is a fascinating discussion. And I think the idea of family, I think we can expand to the community at large. And I think when we humanize people, it's not just about giving them a second chance, but it's about just humanizing them. I mean, my background's in conflict resolution and mediation, collaborative problem solving. And, you know, I started my career 30 years ago doing victim-offender reconciliation. And, you know, it's amazing the stories you hear about people who, you know, when they're embraced by the community, it's not just about community service. It's about being part of the future together. And I think, you know, all this talk about we need to incarcerate people, that's clearly not the answer, but we do need to hold them accountable in a way that allows them to restore their relationship with the community. And when the family's not there for them, then the community needs to be.
Yeah. Hey, Sean, great points. Thanks so much for calling in. This is something you try and think through in the book, too. What are the means of accountability that might be less carceral than what we currently have?
Right. Thanks so much for that, Sean. Yeah, I think I spend a lot of time thinking through what accountability means and how we do need accountability. But oftentimes the idea of accountability that we have is there's this idea of revenge and there's this idea of punishment embedded in accountability when we think about law and order. But how can we have accountability without revenge? How can we have accountability without punishment that we know is going to exacerbate the problem and lead to more harm? And so these kinds of reconciliations that Sean is talking about is vitally important. We need to give resources for that because oftentimes, again, the onus goes to the family, but we need to have people who've experienced this and not necessarily deal with the conflict they've experienced per se, but they still have, they can speak to other conflicts. They can speak on a broader community level to what it feels like to be swept up in these cycles of violence, and they can provide help and healing in that way.
Yeah. after Sito was killed, the DA in his case was Chesa Boudin, who had famously pledged not to try juveniles as adults. But of course, that there still that decision had to sort of be made. What would it have meant for Sito to have been tried if Julius had been tried as an adult?
Well, I spend some time talking about this and how certain family members were pushing Chesa to reconsider his pledge, while other family members were agreed with his pledge, right?
Even both, it sounded like, in some cases.
But part of the issue for them was the seemingly arbitrary nature of the law. So when Sito was 14, there was pressure to try him as an adult. So as a matter of principle, some of his family was saying, well, if he was going to be tried as an adult, then his killer should be tried as an adult, right? And so I think what we don't think about sometimes is, you know, in these election cycles, the pendulum of what we think is justice can swing back and forth really quick. Mm. And there are, you know, the same community members, the same families are impacted by these laws and the way that the pendulum of justice, what we consider justice, swings back and forth. And so how can we think about that? You know, I mean,
you were in at least one of those meetings, right?
Right.
I mean, what were your own feelings or what was your own position there?
I was more conflicted than I thought I would be, you know? I mean,
I would imagine your work would have led you to the position that that juveniles should not be tried as well.
Right, right. I agreed with him, with Chesa in that sense. But I also agreed that it was seemingly contradictory. And because Sito was getting a very different kind of treatment, right? And so how do we reconcile that? You know, I think that part of what we need to do is take a broader and bolder stance on what we think about juveniles. And we can't leave it up to an election cycle. We can't leave it up to the discretion of a particular DA who happens to be in position. I think we have to say, you know, at a broader level, this is how we should treat juveniles, and this is how this is what we think, because I think that consistency actually makes a big difference. I think if Sito was to be given grace when he was 14 years old, that would have changed the nature of that conversation. It would have totally changed the way that they felt, you know, that they could rely or not on the DA in that circumstance.
I mean, at the same time, right, there's only the only way to make change is to make change, right? I mean,
right.
At a certain point, there has to be a moment where things used to be done one way and now they're done another, right?
Yeah, but I think that our notion of progress is oftentimes we imagine it to be linear,
mm-hmm.
but in fact, it goes back and forth, right?
Yeah,
there's
right.
often, reactionary climates that are take place after what we think about as progress that can even be more, can leave us worse off, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, strategically, we think, oh, it's a matter of getting our person in there, right? But how can we safeguard against that? No matter whose person is in there, how can we think about what the law is, why we believe that, why we're taking this stance? And I think that requires a deeper investment, that requires a broader consensus. And I think sometimes politically we go for the route that is going to make the change most quickly, mm-hmm. most expeditiously, but that route can also lead to inadvertent mm-hmm. problems.
So what sentence did Julius then end up receiving?
He ended up receiving 5 years. I mean, because in California, the limit for a juvenile when you're convicted of a crime as a juvenile is that you'll be released on your before your 23rd birthday. So because the crime was committed when he was a 17-year-old, that's why the maximum that he could have gotten in this case was 5 years. And so that was part of the arguments back and forth between Sito's family. Is 5 years enough or is it not because of his age at the time that he committed the crime?
Right, that he was almost 18.
Right.
And that it was, at least as presented in the trial and in the book, like a pretty clearly premeditated attack.
Right, right. Yeah.
I mean, did you think that sentence was just? Like, what would you have liked to see happen for Julius?
I don't think incarceration is the answer, right? I think what I would like to see happen is that he get the resources he needs to, in order to rehabilitate his life. But in this instance, there, what we have is the only mechanism for accountability is incarceration in this particular context. So I think it's important that he did face an accountability, particularly because at the time of his trial, he was denying that he committed the murder. So accountability is vital in that sense.
Hmm. Do you think it was any kind of justice for Sito or his family?
I think it was a kind of justice. I mean, I think that if he wasn't convicted, you know, that would have been seen as Sito's life was valueless to them. But I think that there are other kinds of justice that they cared about more that mm-hmm. couldn't be realized within the law. And mm-hmm. part of that was that they wanted his name to be exonerated. They wanted him to, that the DA to say that they never should have arrested him in the first place, that he didn't commit the crime, that he was innocent. And there was not a context in which they were able to do that or say that. And so that's another reason why they wanted this book, so that the form of justice that they wanted to see could be realized.
Mm. We're talking with Princeton professor Lawrence Ralph about his new book, Sito, an American Teenager and the City That Failed Him. Takes place here in the Mission. I'd love to hear from you. How do you think the juvenile justice system should work? Or do you have questions for Lawrence Ralph about this work or, you know, youth gang violence? You can give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786. Or you can email us forum@kqed.org. We're going to get to more of your calls and comments right after the break. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned.
Star One Credit Union provides you with the tech, tools, and terms to control your money and your lifestyle. Simple, seamless, everyday financial services and solutions. Online and mobile banking backed by the latest technology. Great rates on home, auto, and solar loans. And real people providing real assistance when you need it. At Star One, they always put you first. Become a member at staronecredit.org or visit any of their Bay Area locations. Star One Credit Union. In your best interest.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Princeton anthropology professor Lawrence Ralph about his new book, Sito, an American Teenager and the City That Failed Him. That city, in this case, San Francisco. Let's bring in Damien in Santa Rosa. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. I've got a 6-year sentence about 15 years ago and mm-hmm. spent some time going through the California prison system. I think the part that I'd like to add is that we do have an intervention for people, which is prison, and it's taxpayer funded, and it provides basically almost no rehabilitation at all, and people end up coming out with a high recidivism rate. And the part that your screener suggested that I mention is that the California prison system is 100% gang population. So if you go in there, based off your ethnicity, you're going to be rounded, and region, you're going to be rounded into a gang. You're either going to be a Norteño, a Sureño, a Paisa, a Wood. You know, there's Northern and Southern blacks. And once you get in there, they're going to put you in there. You're going to get a regional leader that is a shot caller that's going to tell you what to do and where to go and who you can talk to and who you can't. They're going to encourage gang activity. You're going to be encouraged to participate in gang activity. And if you don't want to be involved in it, you're either going to get beat up or you're going to have to go to protective custody. And if you go to protective custody, you're going to be looked at as a gang dropout or a snitch, and you're going to face violence again when you're on the streets. So it seems like we have this intervention that everyone's getting, which is to go into the justice system. And there's plenty of other countries that have a great model that have much lower recidivism rates, much higher proportion of money spent on programs for rehabilitation. Not only do we not do that, not only do we not have the money for it, but the prison guards have decided and the wardens have decided that it's easier to keep the peace by empowering the gang leaders to talk to each other so that there's less day-to-day violence based on these shot callers. And that's the system we have. When there's a fight in prison, the whole place gets locked down and the guards pull out the gang leaders to have them talk it out and then go back to their people and have a top-down message come down. And it's kind of hard to get out of gang activity when your whole life is actually being ruled day-to-day by the shot callers.
Right. Man, Damien, thanks for sharing that experience, which sounds both terrifying and traumatic. Really appreciate you just kind of, I don't know how else we would have gotten that perspective. Thank you. Lawrence, I mean, you talk about this quite a lot. You know, street gangs here in the Mission are associated with, perhaps controlled by the gangs inside the prisons. Tell us a little bit more about what you heard in Damien's call and how it relates to what you've studied.
No, I think Damien's characterization perfectly reflected Cito's experience when he went to juvenile hall. And this is why it was very difficult for him because, you know, he was back. I mean, he never left the world of gangs. In fact, a lot of it was more reinforced than was when he first went in. And so for him, you know, in order for him to survive, a lot of those allegiances, he had to kind of rely on a lot of those allegiances. At the same time, he was suspected of murdering someone who belonged to a rival gang, so he was vulnerable, and all the while he's maintaining his innocence. So for someone who's 14 going through that, he was really in a hard spot, and this is why it had lasting reverberations for even when he got out.
Because it just the raw fear and the violence that he experienced inside.
Right. And so when he's in high school now and trying to kind of start over, he can't start over from zero. He's still worrying about who belongs to what gang and if he's vulnerable, if he's walking down the hall by himself, if he's in the bathroom by himself, he's thinking about his time in juvenile hall. He can't undo what has already been instilled in him.
Well, and Miguel being killed.
Right.
Then becomes like an even a greater sign that he might be actively hunted.
Exactly.
Let's bring in another caller here. Let's go to Douglas in Oakland. Welcome, Douglas.
Hi. Well, I'm calling simply to express my own angst on their failure to bring justice system. And I am a parent of 4 adopted children that are Caucasian, and I already had 1 mixed-race child. And when I stepped into that, I found that there is a vast difference in how my children were being treated. And, you know, when they're both found, as was a common practice, to be out drinking and in a dark place with a young lady, the one who is white with the underage child is, I'm called, he's sent home, they get rid of any evidence they could have used against him. And in the other one, I don't even found out that they suspect him of this until they come into my house and take my couch for evidence that didn't exist. And, you know, just it is across the board the way minorities are treated at first encounter with the police. There's an assumption of guilt. There's a worse treatment. You know, they used to tell me how they were in when he was going to Berkeley schools, how they were treating the black kids in the elementary schools tougher because they were trying to train them to be more respectful, et cetera, all this other blatantly biased crap. And then they say, don't worry, even though we're writing them up more here in elementary school, we're not sending it to their junior high. And then I witnessed while one of the sixth grade teachers copied all these reports and sent them ahead to the junior high. Mm. So we agreed just to get our kids educated to stronger discipline, and then that discipline is used against them going forward.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it's eye-opening, it's irritating, it's amazing. And, you know, and I don't want my white kids to feel bad, but then they get to see it, too. And they don't know what to do. And I have a thousand stories about this.
Yeah.
That's why I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
You know.
Douglas,
a black man that raised white babies, and it was painful just to walk down the street.
Yeah. Hey, Douglas, appreciate that call. And, I mean, just the way it gestures at this complex interplay of race and school and cities and policing. Because, you know, I think one thing we can say, too, is that school also kind of failed Sito, right? I mean, this whole dispute with Rashan was kind of like a middle school thing, right? And didn't seem like it was able to, I don't know, squash whatever thing, whatever beef was there. The school was not really capable of handling that level of conflict.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to the last two calls, actually, where you really see like the difference in particularly young boys of color and how the model is to punish them, but also they stand in for the criminals that they could become, right? And they're not given the benefit of the doubt that they will, this is a minor thing, that they will become great scholars, that they will, you know, be productive, right? The assumption is that they'll potentially be criminals, right? And that is reinforced. And the, you know, at the community level, it's really felt. I mean, a common refrain amongst the people that I interviewed for this book was, you know, they want us to kill each other so they don't have to. So there's this idea of, you know, the police and are almost facilitating violence in a way, right? And I think that's seen in the way that a lot of these young people feel about schools, that the schools are, you know, facilitating violence. They're just, you know, benign neglect. They're just, you know, mm-hmm. allowing it to happen, assuming that it will happen. But there's no kind of proactive and productive ways that they're engaging with young people.
One, another dimension of this interplay of race and ethnicity, too, is that, you know, like Damien was describing, these gangs in the Mission also have like a racial and ethnic dimension, right? Serranos and Norteños largely being Latin Americans, and Army Street having a lot of black members, at least is my understanding of it.
Yeah.
Which does also then mirror the what's inside the prisons and sets off that same sense of like, oh, we're these different peoples of color are being set against each other within this place.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that you definitely see that playing out and it being reinforced through incarceration. And so, you know, what's important to me is like, how do we break these cycles? How do we see that they're subject to the same kind of discrimination? They're subject to the same sorts of they're a product of the same kind of inequality. And, you know, their futures are intertwined.
Let's bring in Carrie in Fairfield. Welcome, Carrie.
Hi. I've never called a radio station before. Thank you for
taking
my call.
Thank you for calling.
My brother was, when he was just 18, by a couple of months, he was involved in an incident with three other kids who were actually, one was our neighbor who was much younger, and the other two kids were kids he had met at church, actually. And basically, he was put away for 15 to life after being in the backseat of his own car. They had a gun and shot at a house, but luckily nobody was hurt. The two boys in the front, the one who was driving and the one who had the gun, were put away for, they pleaded guilty and got 14 years at first. But I think, I'm not sure, but I think other things ended up happening to them after they were incarcerated. And then my brother has been in for over 15 years now, since 2008. And, he has experienced a lot of the things that the other callers were talking about. Like, he's put in the Norteño tank. He's mixed race. He's had gang involvement once he was in there, which also got him in trouble. But he's really a nice kid. Like, a lot of these guys, you know, they're just normal guys. And they get caught up in a bad situation. And he was actually convicted because of I think it was like Prop 21 at the time, caused you to have gang enhancement. So everyone in the car was charged as the shooter. And they were charged with street terrorism. And he'd never been in a gang. Like, this is, he's from a small town called Corning up by Red Bluff, California. And his whole jury was white. And eight of them were mothers. He had no equal representation from the Latino community, like, not for trying. There were two alternates who were mixed race, but they never got to go in. And then he ended up getting out of the gangs in the prison. Like, he ended up having to do that solitary, like, get the protection services or whatever. He moved prisons a few times. He's gotten several degrees in there, whatever he can get. And he's still trying to get out. Like, there's still maybe, he might be able to get out based on, like, the youthful offender status. But, like, he has to do all the research and try to figure out how to submit that paperwork. And the lawyers that they appoint are never, like, communicate with them and things like that. And anyways, it's just really sad, like you were saying. Like, I feel like they threw him away. And, you know, the other kid in the back seat with him was on probation, and he was, like, 16 or 14 or something. He was our neighbor. And he wouldn't testify against the other people, but then they put him in jail and, like, threatened him with more more jail time. And then he testified, and then he never went to prison. That kid, the other kid in the back seat. But my brother got thrown away for his entire life after having no priors, not even like a stop sign ticket, you know.
Carrie, what a difficult situation. I hope you've been able to get some support too for just how to deal with, you know, losing your brother to the system in that way. And I really also just want to thank you for bringing that difficult story so people can kind of hear some of these stories. Really appreciate it, because Lawrence, you know, right now we're in a moment because crime has been rising here in the Bay Area, because a lot of it has been young people. There has been a move back towards that kind of Prop 21 style politics for people. That Prop 21 that Carrie was referring to was a juvenile crime measure, I think it passed in 2000. So how do we hold these things, right? Where you've got people who are scared on the streets, you know, might be a nice guy, but might also be a guy that scares people or is going to rob them or whatever. There's different components to every person, and there's the complexities of what it is to actually live together in a wildly unequal society, et cetera. So what do we, aside from just telling the stories of people's humanity, which I think is important in and of itself, what else do we do?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to do a lot of things at the same time. I think that we have to demand a national conversation about some of these issues. I think, you know, I want to thank the callers because I think, again, the family's experiences are very important. I think families are made to feel shame when a loved one is incarcerated. But because of the growth of the prison in the U.S., we know that, you know, so many people are impacted. So many people are. And so our silence oftentimes works against us in demanding change. So I think we can't be silent on these issues. And we have to think about the ways in which they're actually, the supposed solution is actually exacerbating the problem. And I think that you know, we have to keep in mind the data and also the emotional component that's at work. And I say that because right now, for instance, like in New York, they, you know, have the National Guard inside Union Station. And the governor has said that part of the reason she's doing that is because even though statistically there's not more crime, she wants people to feel emotionally safe. So, you know, statistically, when there's not more crime, emotions are at play. Mm-hmm. When there is more, you know, people use data selectively, right? Mm-hmm. And when they don't use data, they use emotions, right? And so there's this emotional component that is easy to kind of grasp a hold of, right? That can sway the public. And so we have to really be attuned to what an uptick actually means, how long that we're actually considering that data, what are the data points, what kind of crime is it, mm-hmm. who is impacting. But we also have to think about how the emotional component is at play and how we're more aware of these things now and how that makes a lot of people feel unsafe. And we can't react to that feeling and give in to that feeling because it produces more violence. It produces more harm in other ways. Hmm.
We have been talking with Princeton anthropology professor Lawrence Ralph. His new book is Sito, An American Teenager and the City That Failed Him. It's really a story about the mission. So if you are interested in this place, you're interested in how it works, and all the people that you're walking by and around and living with here in the city, it's a great book for that. He's going to appear tonight at 7 p.m. at Mrs. Dalloway's bookstore in Berkeley. You can check him out there as well. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much. I also just want to thank our callers today. Some of those stories about your lives are really difficult, but I think they're really important to share with each other, and I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to call and share that with us. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with guest host Leslie McClurg.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.